Each reading.
County of Santa Clara.
Hey, read here, Santa Clara County.
County of Contra Costa.
Thomas Johnson.
County of Gordon.
Fritz Gordon here.
County of Monterey.
Morning, Tristan Olfito from Monterey.
County of Santa Clara.
Mark Reynolds here.
County of Sonoma.
Good morning, Jeff DeBolsky.
Madam Chair, we do have a call.
Thank you. Let us go to approval of the minutes, which is our second agenda item. Hopefully everyone has a chance to review. Are there any comments from my fellow members on the minutes? If you have any minutes. Not seeing or hearing any, we can go to public comments on this item. Is there any public comments? Please come up.
Hi, how are you doing here? Where are you from here? Hi, where are you? Hi, where are you from? Speak at an angle. Happy November. Thank you for the JUIC approval authority public meeting of September 2022. And a thank you that in about 10 working days you would place September 2022 JUIC approval authority meeting master agenda and public meeting audio onto the public on the JUIC public website. I understand Mary Landers is retired at the beginning of the year. Among her jobs is to help facilitate the approval authority public meeting process. From this, I can understand at this time it is sometimes difficult to continue good public meeting practices. A hello to the new person who will be working on this public meeting practices. It is important to always want to look for in what can be open democracy and good public meeting practices, as the ideas tend to work towards our better reasoning and ideas of peace before war or harm. I hope AOC will want to continue good Brown Act practices for the approval authority public meeting master agenda and for its all its documents to be placed on the public website at least 72 hours before an approval authority meeting. I also will continue the efforts to ask our approval authority minutes and learn to have 1 to 3 sentences that includes and can include simple, clear, and a bit more descriptive of public comment time. Hopefully Gary Millay's earlier work about meeting minutes practices can continue, and we can just continue to have conversations about one or two words or sentences that speak to what exactly the public has said in a meeting. To conclude, good luck in how AOC can continue to be a good example nationally in the issues of budget accountability and community accessibility. Thanks, good luck to the meeting today.
Funding for fiscal year 2023, the amount of roughly $1.3 million, and that is centering or focusing on equitable community resilience. So you'll hear more about that in item agenda number 5, where we discuss our various projects. We were one out of 10 applicants who received that award. On the other grant side, the TVTP grant that is targeting violence and terrorism prevention, we did not receive funding for 2023. There were a lot of applicants, there were $40 million requests, and only $20 million was available for funding. We requested a meeting, and we heard good news. Our application was very good. However, FEMA did not want to fund repeated applicants. They wanted to fund others that did not receive funding in the past. However, we're going to try again next year for that grant. It was a grant, good news on that grant. We received the official award for roughly $30 million. There were no financial holds on that award, so we can move forward in funding those projects. As you know, in the UIC grant, they are reviewed, or all the projects are reviewed for effectiveness by FEMA. And last year in the past, we had one or two financial holds, but we're getting better in selecting the projects and then also moving forward and speaking with the FEMA reps. The other area in the WASI grant is the risk methodology issue. Thank you for your support. With our letters to Secretary Mayorkas, in 2023, FEMA wanted to change the risk methodology and change it in a way they would move from a constraining model where they weighed the elements of threat, consequence, vulnerability to a base model that is a variable model that was very good to understand and lack transparency. After our letters from UASI, from all the mayors, went to FEMA, they changed it a little bit. They revised the proposed assessment of the risk methodology enhancement. However, they didn't move the needle all the way back to the normal area. There are some areas that we disagree on. It is not very transparent. However, the bottom line is it could affect the large jurisdictions by three risk rankings. We're number 4 in the country. If we would slip down to 7-3, we could lose up to about $5 to $6 million. And that would affect our program. That would affect funding to our fusion center. It would affect some of our, training exercise programs. So again, all the POCs and UASIs again are going to draft the letter, which we did, going to Secretary Mayorkas to say, hold off on any of the changes. Because as we're going into fiscal year 2023, it looks like we're gonna get a continuing resolution. It's gonna be the same amount of the award that we received what was awarded to the UASIs in 2022. And if this new methodology goes into play, it could add up to 4 new UASIs. So from a mathematical, there's no additional funding in the UASI grant. And if they add new UASIs, that would mean we're going to get a reduction in our funding. So again, we're going to draft a letter. I'll ask for your support to say hold off from making any new changes without more money coming into the grant program. So that is where we are in the UASI grant. An update with our management team, we have 2 vacant positions. One position is under the Extremely Cities grant. Retired Captain Donovan Yin was the program manager, and he has moved on to a promotional opportunity in the private sector, so we're going out and working with RDHR to announce that position and to recruit to fill that position. that should be around either next month or in early January. And the other position is a grant specialist position that was held by Karen Zhang. She had moved on again to promoted opportunity, and we are working with our DHR department to recruit for that position as well. Moving on, this is the action item that I would like to have you approve, and that is our calendar. Our calendar, it remains the same as the past 3 years. We have 5 meetings, and the meetings are laid out in the appendix: January, March, June, September, and November. And so we just ask that you approve the calendar for the fiscal year 2023. And then lastly, our management tracking tool, which is the next appendix. And our next meeting is in January 12, 2023. And at that meeting, we will have, as always, the election of the officers of the OASI. We'll discuss the risk management program. And then we'll have our annual reports for the Bay Area Training and Exercise Program, as well as the NICRIC. And lastly, we will have an update on our fiscal year 2020 was a spending report. So that concludes the GM, but getting back to the action item, it would be for the approval of the fiscal year 2023 WASI meetings, approval party meetings. And if we have any questions, I'll be happy to answer those.
Any questions? We need to go to public comment, I believe, and then we need to take action on the calendar. Please come up for public comment.
Hi, Greg Beekman. Thank you for your patience. I like to speak on item usually in 30, so thank you for your patience for my public comment. I wanted to comment that with the UASI grant money, there's new practices of UASI grants from the federal level. I think it's about 18% that you get. There's a large number that you get from federal dollars for specific federal government programs to be focused on and projects that work with UASI. In addition to that, from whatever I think the grant money is each year, you get an additional 18% that goes to these federally focused projects, and then an additional 10% that is just for the projects that can go over budget. And that's been an awesome addition for yourselves, I think. And I've always been interested in how you can have that process accountable to the public in our future. And real good luck, how I've mentioned it often, it's kind of my regular talking point, how to make that an accountable process with the public and at this meeting time to explain the additional 10% and 18%, and where it's being stored, when it's being used, how it's being used. It can be a lot of help, and I know you guys are good at those things. Good luck in that effort. And just very much of a thank you. I hope you can understand that not getting grant money for the violent extremism programs this year, I think it's a good thing. I think we have our plate full of law enforcement, technology, whole bunch of issues in the Bay Area. We're going to be conservative in the Bay Area to address law enforcement. I think a good decision is made that, thank you for that. We can live on our wits and our good practices now and really rely on our good selves, how to bring out our better principles at this time. I think we can, and it's important to work on our progressive practices now that we're at a place of a conservative base. Thank you.
The authority meeting schedule, which is an attachment. approve. Do I have a second? Second. Thank you, Jessica. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, so we're going to move on to the next item.
Hello. Thank you for having me. So this item has two actions it will do at the end of the presentation. You should have two documents in front of you. The thinner one is the threat and hazard identification risk assessment. And the very thick one is the stakeholder preparedness review, or SPR. Those are official use only documents, so we ask you don't pass them out. I can provide them to you electronically if you'd like, but we also ask again, please do not show them without permission from the UVC management team. All right. So I think most of you know this is a requirement that we have for the recipients of Homeland Security funding is to produce FIRE and SPR. So we do that on behalf of the region with input from staffs of your organizations and subject matter experts around the region. So this is actually the first year that FEMA's required that we do the FIRE. It's been a while since we've had to actually do this. And so we did all three steps of the FIRE this year. One of the things we did is we reduced the total number of scenarios that we have. So the guidance says you should have between 5 and 10. We had 11. And so we really eliminated any of the scenarios that were not drivers of the capability targets. They were kind of unnecessary for the purposes of the document. We did add one new scenario, which is a domestic violent extremism scenario focused on school shooting. And then we refreshed the cyber scenario and the complex coordinated attack scenario. We also looked at all of the capability targets to see if we felt like our goals were set at the right place. So for example, previously we had used a percentage of 20% to estimate the number of people with access and functional needs in any community that might need services. And working with subject matter experts, we actually move that to 35% estimate. That aligns with Cal OES's perspective on the state of California, so we thought that was more appropriate. But as you'll see, as we get into the SPR, there were some implications for that in terms of how much progress how far we still have to go in some of these areas. FEMA requires that we use standard capability targets for the FIRE. These are great, except sometimes they're too narrow. They don't necessarily capture all of the functions that need to occur in order to reach a core capability. And this is especially problematic with the national priority areas. So the capability targets that fall under the national priority areas, we really didn't feel like they were measuring all of the investments that we were making in the region in these areas. So we're addressing this by creating four new capability targets. So one in planning, one in interdiction and disruption, health and social services, and cybersecurity. All right, so the stakeholder preparedness review. So this is the one that we do have to do every single year. So we went through the process and we assessed all 32 capability targets, plus the four custom capability targets that we created. We use a variety of methods, and we asked subject matter experts to weigh in on where we were, how close are we to reaching our targets, why we still have gaps between what we need to do and what we feel like we can actually do, and what are some strategies that we can use to close those gaps. And this year, we actually, for both parts of the process of FIRE and the SPR, we had record engagement, so thank you really again to all of you whose staff really are the ones who provide all the input for this process. So here is an example of some of the data that we get from the FIRE. So you can see the core capabilities in red, the percentage in red, those are the ones where we dropped in capacity since the last time we assessed that core capability. The ones in green are where we felt like we had increased capacity. And then the ones in black are the ones where we pretty much kept status quo or we sustained that capability. The big reason that was cited for the ones in red is staffing. And as many of you know, In every, you know, all of our public safety disciplines, we've lost personnel over the past couple of years, and that's really impacted our ability to build capability in the region. It's also the case for the ones that are in black. So maybe we made a lot of investments in a particular area, but unfortunately those investments were kind of offset by lack of personnel. And so we, you know, subject matter experts felt like we really hadn't grown in those areas. Other reasons cited for sustainment or a loss in capability were, you know, everyone focused on COVID response, left little time for other things. We also didn't hold as many trainings or exercises over the past couple of years because of social distancing. So those are other reasons that we didn't really. And there's also a handful where it, as I mentioned in the fire, it's going to appear like we lost capability, but it's really actually that we just moved our target farther out. So any of the ones like mass care or public information and warning, where we have a metric in there to reach a certain population, people with access and functional needs, but we move the bar higher. And so we, you know, our capability looks like it's less because we just now have farther to go. But we didn't necessarily lose capability in those areas. All right, so that's all we have on the thyroid SPR for a moment. We'll come back to that, the action item. So this is the HUB funding formula. So the formula that we use approximates what the federal government currently uses in the risk formula, and the risk methodology, as Craig was alluding to. And it's a combination of population at 49%, asset risk at 29%, and economic risk at 22%. Population risk comes from census data, comes from population density data, commuter data. The asset risk is from vulnerability, consequence, and threat, and that data comes from the CalPOP asset catalog. And then economic is gross domestic product by metropolitan statistical area data, as well as data from the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis. Those three elements are combined together, population, economic, risk, and this comes out with a percentage of risk for each hub in the region. So as you can see, the change is minimal from last year's percentages, and we're recommending a vote of this form, a vote to apply this formula for the next 3 years. So just to freeze it, keep it this way for the next 3 years. And of course, we won't know what the actual numbers will be until, or the outcomes will be until the notice of funding is released. And that is all I have to present for you. And now we have the two action items.
Okay, so we should do them separately.
Yes, we should vote on them separately. Mm-hmm. Probably should have done B and then A.
And we have to do them. Do we have any public comment on this item? Okay, come on up. Maybe I'll help you come up after.
Hi. A lot on this item. I don't quite know where to start. I just, I'm surprised that West has, you know, this has been a trend over the past few years that East funding has gone down. South has gone up a bit, and West is at 46%, and that's a lot. I'm curious why that is. I noticed that you're voting on HUB funding formulas today based on zero things, and I'm assuming this HUB funding is for all items within, you know, that Bayuasi covers, and that includes, you know, health and human services and emergency planning. Wouldn't it make more sense to, in the future, learn to do these approvals of HUB funding formulas within emergency preparedness items? I think that makes a lot more sense. And I think, you know, the initial work that we've done towards these efforts in 2017 and 18 or so, I think we have to continue those good efforts. And it takes practice to do those things. And like I said, we're at a really conservative place right now in the Bay Area. I hope this could be a time that we feel safe and comfortable there, that we want to learn how to
work again towards our more progressive ideals, and good luck in that work, and thank you.
Okay, so we are in the first action, which is to approve these two documents.
Yes.
The diary and the scan. Do we have a motion to approve?
Madam Chair.
Yes, do you have a comment?
May I allow it? Yes.
Of course.
Okay, thanks. So can you share a little bit of insight on, was there a significant piece that made the shift for the hubs in the decrease of three hubs and the increase of one hub? And then number two, what the methodology is for, or the rationale for thinking to approve these percentages now for the next three yeah. years. So I just would like a little more on that, yeah. if you're able to.
Yeah, so the shift was the census, they got new census data this year. So there was a slight shift in the census, in the population data. That was primarily what moved it 0.0 whatever percentage. That was what the main driver was. I mean, the asset data hasn't really changed because we don't have any new assets in the catalog. The economic data wasn't significantly different. So it was really the population, the new data we got from the census that created that. The rationale for freezing it for the next 3 years. So again, the asset risk doesn't change much, and we're not going to have new population or economic data because that data, the economic data, only comes out every 3 years, and the census data only comes out every 5 years. So when we were changing it every year, we were really only changing it by whatever changed in the asset catalog, which wasn't really anything. And the other element is we actually pay for this service, so it's a cost savings to just freeze it as opposed to refreshing it every year when really the data is not changing.
All right, thank you for that. So mostly it was the population.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? All right. And I'm just trying.
So we're talking about freezing for the next 3 years, and you're specifically talking about the percentages, not the formula, correct?
Correct.
Yes. Yeah. Does say formula.
Yeah.
Percentages.
Yes. Yes. Correct. It is the percentages. The formula, it will continue to be what the formula is. I don't think we would necessarily change ours just because DHS is thinking about changing the risk methodology, because I think, as Craig explained, there's no basis for the changes they want to make are really not apparent or justifiable. So we would keep the formula the same. Thank you for clarifying. It's just the percentages.
Okay. And then my follow-up question to that is, so we're asking for 3 years right now due to the time frame when data comes in. Would the next request be 2 years then to match the census data?
Probably yes. I mean, I think we could refresh it in 3 years because we have new economic data by then. And then probably it would make sense to go to another 2 years when the population, when the census data would be released again. I mean, unfortunately, as we saw last year, because typically the census data, typically we present this to you, this year is November, but last year, remember, I think we got a little bit screwed up. Even though they released the overall census, they didn't actually release the detailed information that we need. So assuming that they actually do release it again in 5 years, then that's when we would revise the percentages.
Thank you. I just want to make sure that detail doesn't get lost.
Yeah.
Any other questions? All right. Can we go back to the previous slide?
Yeah.
Okay. So now, just I don't want us to get confused. Because Jessica asked questions about we're doing the first, not that you're confusing. Action A, we need a motion to approve the IRA and SPR.
So moved.
Who was that, Dana? Okay. Second?
Second.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right, thank you. Now we have another item, which is to approve the HUD funding percentage for 3 years.
Yes, thank you.
Do we have a motion to approve?
Motion to approve.
Thank you, Jessica. Second?
Second.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, thank you. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you.
Our fifth item is the quarterly grant funded program updates, which I'm going to ask Janelle to introduce.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For you is the item for the last quarterly grant funded program updates. Quarterly, we come in front of you with the last year with 5 different programs to provide an update on activities and accomplishments. And you see the first presentation will come from Matt Devine for Ben. She's not here today. She has some kids at home, so we'll look out for all those cute children. I'll show you pictures. So Matt will present on BATEP, and then he will introduce Christopher catastrophic planning and so on and so forth. And then we'll take questions at the end. Okay,
good morning, Madam Chair, Approval Authority members. My name is Matt Devine. I'm the Training and Exercise Project Manager for Bay Area WASI. As you know, BATEP has been conducting and leading the training throughout the region since mid-2020, and I'm here to give you an update on our progress throughout the first 3 quarters of 2022. In January, we'll be back in front of you to give you a formal report during our annual report. So through September 30th of 2022, we've trained 2,060 students across 90 courses. We provide training in 7 different disciplines, from the fire service, law enforcement, emergency management, public information, cybersecurity, public health, and community preparedness. To note here is we have a number of cybersecurity courses that are beginning in our quarter 4, and then we'll also carry over into the beginning of 2023 as well. On the right side of the screen, you'll see our geographic reach program that captures our members who are participating in our training. This is updated whenever a course is completed to give us a good idea of who is taking our trainings and to make sure that we have equitable distribution throughout the region for training opportunities for all our members. One of the things that continues to be a problem for us is people who sign up for classes and don't show up to them. They receive the moniker of no-shows, and so it affects, for us as BATEP, we perceive that as a lost training opportunity for participants in our region when an empty seat is left unfilled. And I would request that you would share with your member agencies the registration process, how easy it is to register, unregister yourself, and a simple email or phone call will suffice. We do enact a 6-month suspension for people who don't attend or who no-show to our programs, rather than serve as a punitive measure, we would just like to ultimately have all our seats filled in our training courses. So to date has been a very busy year. We had our Golden Eagle exercise in May that focused on critical transportation. We ran a local pandemic preparedness tabletop series, and we have begun a supply chain resiliency series, which Christoph Arnold will share more information about when he comes up. But I'd like to share with you some highlights from our second annual Public Safety Preparedness Summit that was held last week at the Marines Memorial Hotel in San Francisco. Special thanks to Mary Ellen Carroll for her keynote presentation, to Erica Artiseros Brown for her beautiful rendition of the national anthem, to Carrie Thomas, the Director of Preparedness Grants Division for FEMA, who gave us some great insight on the grant allocation system and their management on the federal level. And then lastly, we were receiving nothing but a positive response for Elizabeth Newman's presentation on counterterrorism and the complexities of domestic violence extremism. So this year we organized the conference into 3 tracks: mass notification, cyber resilience, domestic violence extremism, and our Securing the Cities program. So the feedback has been resoundingly positive from all our participants as far as the professional individual professional development as well. The DVE tract featured gun violence restraining orders, and that discussion focused on early intervention to prevent these violent acts, and that was really welcome information for the entire region. The mass notification seminar continued to meet the need for networking across the Bay Area and learning best practices from other regions as well, such as the Portland UASI. And then this was the first time the cybersecurity personnel have had the ability to collaborate together and meet with their regional partners, and that room was filled, standing room only, for 2 days for those presentations. And we had a Securing the Cities program, conducted a tabletop exercise that was had participants from across the region involved in that program. So approximately 300 people attended the conference, with an additional 100 that have participated in our regional pandemic preparedness tabletop exercises. And so the feedback survey is currently still open. We are trending right now at 4.3 out of 5 stars for our feedback from our participants in our summit. So if you haven't yet filled out a form and you participate in the summit, we'd be welcome to hear your feedback from that. These presentations will be available, the presentations from the summit will be available for download from our UASI website, and we'll be releasing a summary report very soon. We have a couple of upcoming key events. We have our, as I mentioned, the Supply Chain Resilience Seminar Series is continuing through early February. Please take note of the Golden Eagle exercise that is upcoming on May 18, 2023. And additionally, we're setting up planning teams to discuss an active attacker series that we'll be conducting in the region. If you haven't yet, or your region has not met with Captain Juan Daniels, who is our SFPD liaison to UASI, please reach out to me or Corinne or our BayTEP team, and we can coordinate that to make sure that not only training needs, but your voice is represented in those upcoming series as well, and that we're giving you an appropriate amount of support. And then through our priority area for community resilience, we'll be looking into supporting CERT exercises, so please let us know if your jurisdictions, particular representatives who want to be involved in the CERT training and relating to the training and exercise that we're planning on providing, and to focus on community resilience priorities, to reach out to the BayTEP program so we can include them in our planning teams as well. And then lastly, we have our sights set on another successful summit plan for 2023 in November to continue the great work that we did this year. Thank you for your time, and if you have any questions for me.
We're going to hold questions to the end of the presentation. We'll leave that
open. Okay. Great. Thanks so much. I'd like to introduce Christoph Arnold. He is head of our RC-PGP program.
Good morning, everyone. There's Matt and Corinne's details if you need them. So Christoph Arnold here to present the Regional Catastrophic Preparedness Grant updates. As Craig mentioned, the biggest update we have since our last meeting in September was that our FY22 grant, which is the Equitable Community Resilience Project, was awarded. So the kickoff meeting for that will start in a couple months, so look for that email. The foundations of this program or project is equity, community preparedness, and climate resilience. So very excited to kick this one off. Since September, some of the stuff that we've completed for the other three ongoing programs is for the FY19 CPOD project. We've delivered a few CPOD and disaster logistics trainings. For the pandemic preparedness, as Matt mentioned, we have completed the regional local tabletop exercises, and we did the regional one on November 1st as part of the summit. And that one had about 125 participants and really good feedback so far. And we will share the ARs for that in the coming months. And the last update that we have that we've completed yesterday, the third of the 9 seminar series, which was open only to the private sector, and as well the second one, or the next, or the following one, sorry. So 3 of 9 done. Coming up for the next couple months till January, for the FY19 project, which is the CFI project. We have exercise planning with four jurisdictions, so those will be done by January. We, as Matt mentioned as well, we have on the 18th of May, we are going to be doing the Golden Eagle exercise. The initial planning meeting will be held on January 11th. So if you're interested or any of your jurisdictions are interested in that, please do send me an email and we'll get you linked up for that. Actually, I'm just going to take one moment to highlight something about the Golden Eagle exercise. So the general is going to be a full-scale functional exercise, which is regional. And then the overall scenario is meant to be pandemic preparedness. But just so that you know, you can tailor it to what your jurisdiction's needs are. So if you want to do an EOC activation, do CPOD, or whatever it may be, and then exercise fire, wildfires in the north, or if San Francisco wants to be flooding, you can actually tailor that to it and add our resources that we already have, so you can use our contractors to do it, so you don't have to use your own. So just a little side note for taking that first. Other updates on that program are that we have the mass care and shelter planning toolkits is updated and will be made available. And so will the MAC guide, which was revised for post-pandemic, and that will be also provided and made available for you in your jurisdictions. A couple other off-the-shelf, ready-to-use toolkits are going to be the crisis communications, actually the PIO toolkit. Very useful for any kind of information to get out to the communities was transmitted. We are going to continue with our technical assistance to all the different jurisdictions, and we are going to finally, in the FY22 kickoff for the community, or equitable community resilience project. I believe that is it. Thank you. And if you have any questions, do not hesitate to ask me either at the end of this, or you have my email and phone number. Happy to answer anything.
Dave Rocha, I'm standing in today for Don McGinn, who was mentioned earlier. Don left the STC program to go work for a property management company in the city of San Francisco. So a couple things I'd like to cover that, on the program where we're at is our budget was approved. One of the things going on with the budget is we're not seeing the expenditures when it comes to overtime and backfill within agencies, which is a bit of a surprise, because especially on the fire service where it's kind of constant staffing classified relief scenario, but we're not seeing that. The good news is CWMD allows us to move the money. So we've got a lot of money that's been moving over to equipment from in that category. So when we're looking at doing purchases, we go forward with backpacks and mobile devices and marine devices, that's opening up some funding for us when it comes to those things. In terms of our 3 years, as mentioned earlier, we just completed at the summit a tabletop exercise. So that was one of the key milestones for us in the program, is to get through that. Your group will receive at your next meeting the after action report, probably receive it before that to view as well on that tabletop. So everything went very well. There's like with any tabletop, there were lessons learned for the group on mainly information sharing and how to get resources, especially when you go outside of an agency and moving that, and how to get it from the, you know, from the op area to the region and from the state and the federal government in terms of radiation and getting them involved. So we are looking at functional exercises or drills that will happen in the spring to build toward what will be a full-scale exercise in the fall, probably sometime around the summit this next year as we move toward that. We're planning on trying to leverage some of the STC, which is really prevention, interdiction, screening, interdiction, and CWMD doesn't like to say response. That's a whole nother thing, so right of boom stuff. So what we're trying to do is we're gonna do maybe a day of the STC side, the pre-event, and then second day, that'll be the response side to get responders involved in that is what we're looking at doing that. And keeping things clean and the budget separate when it comes to that. We had a few visits that took place here in September and October. For the SC, we had the Assistant Secretary of DHS, Gary Rascott, visit, and we had all of the SDC regions. They're doing a semi-annual meeting. We were the first to get to host that, and we appreciate the Port of San Francisco and offering the building or the space to do that, and that was a very good meeting. Our region is significantly different than the other regions within the SDC program. And I say that because we have a lot of agencies that work together, where the other SDC regions are one large city, and they're just starting to expand to some of the adjacent cities. So when you look at Houston, I don't think Chicago's even added anybody on the outside at this point, but Houston, New Orleans, it's a different model, where we went large to start all the way from Fresno to the Oregon border and into Nevada for Washoe County or the Reno area. So we are significantly different when it comes to that. The group got the second day of the visit was a visit to Livermore Lab. We got to go over and see the equipment that RAP 7 has just outside of the lab and their response. We will be collaborating with CST on a BayX exercise that's coming up. It's President's Day week, so it's kind of it's a short week, but that's the week that we're looking to make sure that we leverage some of the information on drills and the availability to adapt to everybody within the program. So some of the equipment, we now have all of the PRDs in stock. So we have about 800 that are currently available. We have about 38 currently available RIDs that are available to agencies within the SDC region. Next week, we will do the selection for the backpacks. And then we'll, like I said, the number 5 there is actually pretty low. We're gonna probably almost double that with the money that we have available. And then we're gonna also be looking at mobile car-based kind of systems. And then marine systems as well that we could use as well to push that out. Right, and then I just already mentioned in beginning of January, kind of a different funding source, we're gonna be doing some hazmat operational readiness drills around the Bay Areas, rotating through the hubs. So we'll be down in Santa Clara, in San Francisco, up in the Santa Rosa area, and then over in Contra Costa County. And the focus is to bring together the OES typed teams that are in the Bay Area, type 1, 2, and some 3s, to participate in that. Thank you very much. And I'll be turning it over to Jody Trapsaro.
Thank you. Thank you, Chief. Good morning. I'm Jody Trapsaro. I oversee the domestic violence experience and targeted violence and terrorism prevention programs. To kick off our presentation, we'll start with the DPE project overview. As mentioned, our gun violence restraining order training was very popular. It's a new legislative action that allows for teachers to actually submit requests for gun violence restraining orders when observing behaviors of concern. Our myriad of projects underway, I'm going to separate them out into the micro projects. Of course, they're driving a lot of our investments in this space, especially the early upstream interventions. Right now, we are scheduling 2 crime gun intelligence center symposiums, a variety of police and violence extremism classes, behavioral threat assessment classes, as well as school safety symposiums and other early upstream interventions, including mental health, film contests, and anti-bullying training. The November domestic violence extremism track at the conference, of course, was very well received. And we have currently selected the next round of anti-bullying, the schools that will receive the anti-bullying training. Our first school safety symposium is going to be coordinated with the San Mateo County Office of Education. It's going to be on January 11th. And our other school partners are building out the media literacy training and delivering the media literacy teacher-led training across Santa Cruz, Santa Clara, and Monterey counties. All of these evidence-based prevention training is funded by UWASI. We are also partnering with Roadblocks on the school safety symposiums. So all of the schools are under selection right now for the mental health student film contest, and we are expanding the TBTP grant program with another 12 schools for fiscal year 22 UWASI grants. We just released our cross-sector threat assessment training for December 1st, and there was an overwhelming response of interest. So we'll be coordinating several more of these over the upcoming months. Here's a quick overview of the schedule. Should any of you get a call about trying to get into these trainings, because like I said, I received, I'll say, at least 100 people saying we need more of these. And of course, we're immediately scheduling more, knowing that the interest is very high. Next week, we have our California Prevention Practitioners Network meeting. There's over 100 people registered, and we have a great lineup of speakers, including the FBI and, of course, our NICREC and school partners. Thank you very much. I have the privilege of introducing Corey Reynolds to go over his report.
Thank you, Jody. Good morning, Approval Authority. I am Corey Reynolds. I'm the General Manager of BayRex, and here today to just provide a really brief update as we close out our fiscal year 2021 grant support from the ULC. Again, much appreciated. Most importantly, I'm going to focus on what BayRex will look like in 2023 in the absence of our ULC funding. So to just kick off with that, two major, I would say, portfolios or buckets of our work, really focusing most of our efforts on regional P25 voice interoperability. This is a bit of a shift for us. Over the past 5-6 years, BayRex has kind of approached voice interoperability with our P25 systems, as well as a portfolio of projects and work groups on FirstNet and public safety broadband. As the region, as you know, your jurisdictions and others across the region have adopted FirstNet or chosen not to, our role has really changed, and there's less sort of formal regional coordination that's needed on that broadband side. So, and I'll talk about our strategic plan here in a second, but working with stakeholders and with our board of directors, we identified these two areas as our key focus areas for 2023. On that regional P25 side, that includes our monthly radio operators meeting. And as we went through our strategic planning process, it was loud and clear that that's the most important thing that we do as an organization, is facilitate these monthly meetings of the radio operators around the region and use that time to solve any sort of interoperability issues that come up month to month. We also host an annual system key exchange with that group, where the radio managers from across the region all come together and share system keys with programming information, allowing partner systems to put interoperable radios on each other's systems, really facilitating quicker and easier mutual aid responses. This requires a lot of coordination on system ID programming, coordination with our partners at CalSeq and CalOES, and lately a much bigger focus on security, both of radios that may be lost or stolen, or issues that we're seeing around the region as signal jamming incidents increased. Then we also run the JPA itself. BayRex is a joint powers authority, and based on our charter and bylaws, that requires 4 meetings of our board a year, some legal and compliance, obviously insurance, budgeting, auditing, financial management, and then just keeping a website and communicating with our members. This is all guided, that sort of forecast of 2023 was all guided by our new strategic plan. BayRex maintained 4 goals in our strategic plan. Our previous 3-year plan expired in 2021, and we've adopted the 2022 plan now. Again, focusing on optimizing our management and administration in the face of losing some grant support and just relying on our member fees and our reserve fund and the authority sort of general fund, for lack of a better word. That requires us to optimize some of our operations and processes just to realize some of that cost savings. I already talked about promoting voice communications interoperability, and you notice kind of the strategic elimination of the word data within that. In the previous 3 years, we had a specific goal on monitoring and managing FirstNet. I mentioned that, but our role in that has sort of changed. And what we're trying to do now is really just support our member agencies in their broadband deployment. So we provide some decision support tools. We share information and make connections among BayRex members and FirstNet Authority and FirstNet by AT&T. But you'll see the down arrow next to that. We do anticipate this goal sort of reducing in level of effort, budget, and resources over the next few years. And then lastly, enhancing our communications and information sharing. I mentioned security as a big topic, and one piece of that is having Bay Ricks as a central hub with some more secure portals, whether that's SharePoint or whatever it is, to host and collaborate on more sensitive information that does not go up on our general website. So that's what next year looks like for Bay Ricks. And once again, thank you all for the approval of the FY21 funding, which went to, you know, again, achieving those four goals from our previous strategic plan. And that's all I've got. Thanks, hand it over to Janelle.
All right, Janelle, thanks to you. It's always a lot of information about all the work that you're doing. I appreciate the patience. I'd like to open it up to my colleagues on the approval authority. Any comments or questions? Please just go.
Madam Chair, may I ask? All right, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment, I just want to thank the entire management team and everything that goes behind putting on that summit. It's really taken, it's a huge lift to put on any kind of an event. The logistics are off the hook. I thought the venue was great. I think the most important thing that the management team did this year and this board did was reconnected folks together. It was a great opportunity to really just see people again, catch up with our practitioners and our colleagues to discuss issues that continue to be, you know, that are emergent to us, and kind of reflect back on what we've been going through the last couple of years with the public health crisis globally, and specifically here in California. So I thought it was very well done. I was able to attend the first 2 days. I couldn't make the third day. But it was just really good. The conversations at the tables were really important. The panel discussions helped drive, you know, either validation of the work that was done or provided food for thought going forward, you know, should we have another public health emergency. But I think also it helped drive us towards some more broader thinking of, you know, of an area-wide disaster that has nothing to do with health. I think a lot came out of the processes we experienced during COVID, especially the logistics issues and the resourcing issues that we all face. I think that's going to be valuable going forward for other events, such as earthquakes. It's probably a really good example. So hats off to the entire team, all the hard work. And I know it takes a lot of programming, lining up the speakers and so on. So I thought it was, Madam Chair, I thought it was very well done. And I think everybody that sits here, it was the right thing for us to support that.
I know it's not a voting item, but I second. Yeah, I'll just say every event that y'all have done has been very well received. So I absolutely support the team. Any other questions? Okay, we will go to public comment on all four items.
Practices actually needed. I think it can be an open process, and that openness
is the idea of a better preparedness for all of us, I think. And we should, it's work, but we shouldn't be afraid to make those steps. Strange to do, but it's good steps, I think, for ourselves, and how to build the future of a such plan. And we don't have to keep those things secret. That's a lot to learn how to do. Good luck in those efforts, if it is even applicable. Just to bring that out. And then finally, to mention training exercise programs, San Diego, UAC, they have a way of working that, Bay UAC, they encompass a lot of programs. San Diego UAC is more specific to training against national security preparedness issues. You have a more encompassing approach that I think I really hope you take to heart, that you can be able to practice health and human services first, and make that the focus of how we talk about IOMs, and then we bring in the national security preparedness issues instead of the other way around. San Diego UAC, they're a very focused item, as they have two other county agencies that cover emergency preparedness stuff. Things to consider. I hope I can make this more clear in the future. Thank you.
This is not an action item. So we will go on to our Nick Rick friend meeting. Thanks, Chair. Hi.
Thank you. Thank you, members of the approval authority. And I'm glad we have a large audience today for this topic. But one of the things that we've been working on for quite some time are election threats, election security. Really three prongs that we're looking at as far as the threat landscape. The first, of course, being physical, cyber, and social media threats. And we had all three this last couple of days and proceeding to that. And we actually started off October 19th. We did a national call for law enforcement on election security threats, and some briefings on some of the groups. And there's several groups that are targeting elections. And there are actually groups that think that the ones that have been involved in the domestic violence extremist side aren't violent enough. I think that they should be more violent. We also had in our area, because we always have had an issue, at least within the last 10 years, with state nation actors that have tried to use cyber methodologies to attack networks, and especially at the local government level. So we believe we had a few of those that happened, at least a few incidents throughout the country that we're still trying to evaluate and looking at kind of the way those compromises could happen. But the good news is, because of the great work that's been done by CISA, on the DHS side, FBI partners, the outreach we've done to local election officials about secure networks, compartmentalizing the networks themselves, so they are connected to the rest of the county networks. They've been very safe and secure. But we still have these potential compromises that happen at a county level. And we've seen that from our nation state actors, because as we've hardened our federal systems and federal capabilities, they're going after the smaller counties, they're going after the smaller organizations that may not have the expertise and capabilities. But what we have offered is to go out and do assessments for folks, work with them, both from the federal side, CISA, our FBI partners, and our cyber team as well, to go out and help. And when we have had incidents where local city departments or county agencies have been attacked by denial of service attacks or infiltration, we send folks out to help them restore their networks, and it's worked out very well. And when we led up to our election this year, we had the cyber task force at the state level. That was comprised of our Secretary of State, our Governor's Office of Emergency Services, our California Highway Patrol, along with our Fusion Center network, and local election officials as well. We had a command post stood up to identify any of these threats. And one of the things that we did for the first time this year, which you'd think we'd had before this year, but we actually had geospatial capabilities set up to identify threats in real time around the nation to get reporting. So that was the first time we've ever been able to do that seamlessly. There's all textual data, but we've integrated the visual capabilities to see those threats and identify where we may have the same threat actors engaged in different locations, especially when we have telephonic threats, which we had. We had threats to election officials. We had threats to currently elected officials, and we're dealing with that. And in one location, we actually had, and this was out of our state, a person actually walked in with a knife saying, unless they stop the election, he was going to start cutting people. They closed it down for about 30 minutes, got the person taken care of by law enforcement, but it's an education on making sure. We don't necessarily want to have law enforcement right there at the election site, but we did have a lot of folks out there that were poll watchers or folks that were taking video. And then we did get those reports as well, but you know, that may be some election violations, but oftentimes that's First Amendment protected activity, so it sits right on those lines. And that's something from an intel perspective, unless there's additional information about that activity, that we get further into the weeds on. But we currently have folks still online that are looking at targeting the elected officials, looking at targeting the election process, and you're going to continue to use what we've learned from this last few weeks for next year. And we do have a planned nationwide elections call next week. I'll get that out to everyone, and it's just the post-election call, go through some of the methodologies that we saw being used in the last couple of weeks, see the misinformation, disinformation campaigns that were out there. I know people don't want to talk about that too much, but we did have a lot of people that were sending direct texts to groups of folks. We had people sending emails with false information. So those are the little things that people do to discourage folks from voting, or making them think that their vote doesn't count, or making them think that the election process is not working or has been compromised. And for those nation state actors, they were directly advocating targeting certain groups out there. We had non-affiliated groups, plus we had, you know, the Cyber Russian Army and folks like that, that were saying, we want you to go after these people. So those are the majority threats that we have, but we are always concerned about people with physical threats, mass casualty violence, and those indicators. So we have a project that we are working on, have been since 2018 with our social media companies for looking for threats like that online. We do have a process for them reporting them directly, and for us to get that information to any of the 5,000 public safety answering points around the country in real time. So we're very active on those threats and monitoring those threats and making those calls to low latency so that if we have an actor that is planning on doing an attack or stating that they're going to do an attack and posing with weapons, and we get something to say hello to them as quickly as possible. So that's a real quick down and dirty overview of our processes, what we did. I don't want to get too granular in the 21 incidents that we had nationwide, but if anyone has any interest in learning more, we'll make sure you get invited to the call, which I'll get you the time and date for that for the approval authority. I'm working on that right now so we can get that out there with cross country. So thank you.
Thanks, I appreciate it. I'm sure everyone is aware, not just who knows if they're too much or not, that the attack on Skip has been in San Francisco 2 weeks ago. It's a horrific event. Part of my responsibility is running the 911 system. We're very, very grateful to the dispatcher who is one of our best and, you know, used her experience and her instinct to respond. But I know I've spoken to other elected officials in San Francisco in general, and it's a really fraught situation right now for everyone. And so we appreciate the work that you do. And, you know, that really got very real, as they say, in San Francisco for us. And, you know, more is kind of come out from above all of that, but it's just, I'm pleased that we seemingly got through this. This past week, relatively, it sounds like probably more. We obviously have a lot more than we saw. Felt like we got through okay.
Absolutely. And just before that call, we're planning, we rolled out U.S. Capitol Police. I talked to the chief after the daily attack about what we can do to improve security capabilities and education for all elected officials, because these folks that we're talking about, these several groups, they're specifically targeting whichever candidates they don't like. And to the point where they're advocating violence, death threats, and all it takes is one person who is not stable, who thinks this is a good idea, that will show up at somebody's doorstep. You saw that in real life. Our U.S. Capitol Police, we did have the first appointment of U.S. Capitol Police in the country to a remote location. They are in our office. We've had a few more added since that Friday, but their goal was to make sure that the threat prevention side, that we're dealing with every threat as quickly as possible. And then for working with local law enforcement, that's the other part of this conversation, making sure that local law enforcement has the best connection possible to any threat information that U.S. Capitol Police has, as well as the people we have here, being able to help with assessments that we have people that we believe are at risk of harming legislators. So, something like that. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Here we can open it to you.
Hi, good evening here. Thanks a lot for the report. It is, the Nancy Pelosi issue has really brought out for me that the work that you guys need to do. And you have a lot to balance. What I tried to say in the previous item to speak about training exercise program issues is that. San Diego UWASI has a very specific role to basically just do training and exercise program things, whereas Bay UWASI here, you have a broad range of issues. And the Nancy Pelosi issue has really brought home what you guys have to often concentrate on. And thank you for that work, thank you for the efforts, and what was described as all the things that you have to prepare for with an election process. Thanks. But the election process is now over, and hopefully we can start to our focus has been shifted towards just our better self, I guess. it's with that, I just wanted to again remind the importance of what I'm trying to offer here today is not. I understand there's a bit of semantics involved in wanting to place health and human services ideas first and how to talk about issues, but it's those good practices that just sets in our mind what can be a good way to be thinking and working and to address our issues. And it's from that, then we can address the importance of national security preparedness and what was talked about on this item. So thanks a lot, and good luck to our efforts in the next year.
We can move on to our next item, which is our travel expenditures.
Good morning, everyone.
Hi, Tristan.
Tristan Lombardo, CFO. As always, my report today is for discussion. Our bylaws require that the management team report on travel costs. The last time I reported on travel was back in September 2020. So travel activities resumed in March of this year. To date, since that resumption, the total of the travel costs reached about 22,000. The largest event was the annual Homeland Security Conference. And in July, four members of our management team gave presentation and made a good representation from there. The rest of the travel are all depicted on my report. And on a separate note, we released all FY22 MOUs last week of October. So I believe most of them are all in the signature process at your agencies. Please feel free to reach out to me if you have any questions about your projects funded by FY22. That's all I have for today.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, well, that is, do we have a public comment? Public comment on travel, please come up.
Hi, thanks for your report. Just to speak to you the travel issues. Well, I just wanted to speak to you a quick reminder that good luck in practicing, always looking for accountability practices and how to make your accounting clear in this process. And I think you guys have always done a really good job on that. And it takes time for yourselves to figure out how to do things well. You come through with something you do really well. So. Good luck in those good efforts. What I think, how to describe the future of federal additional funding dollars you're getting, how that could be a more open public process. Good luck. And with that, about the travel reports, I noticed Corrine Birchshire, I think her last name, she traveled to San Diego, and I think a few people have, and I've just recently, I'm transitioning to move to that area. And I've written you a few of you a few letters recently, and I'll write to yourselves again. They work in a bit of a different system, I think, where San Diego UWASC is a bit more isolated in just working on training programs. And then emergency services are handled by two other San Diego County agencies, mainly. Just to get offer a description of the situation, and what I hope with me moving there, it'll be interesting to learn what my part will be in that process, and then to definitely talk to you guys and what we can develop from there. A quick note that they're thinking of building a trolley from San Diego into Tijuana, Mexico. Which is just heaven. That's really important, good work to want to trust and work towards those goals. And that's the sort of things they're working on down there. So, talk about that stuff. That's how we can talk about that in the future. Thank you. Hi, Blair Beekman, speaking today. Thanks a lot for the meeting. I guess I wanted to offer that you had a hub funding for the next year, the financial year 2023. You don't anymore offer what projects are being asked for by each hub. You used to put that in public meetings. And I hope you can return to that practice. You do it in about June of each year. And it'll be hopeful to see that again. It brought to me a point that, you know, in the past few years, we've been kind of tightening up here at AUSC, and I think a few practices have been lost a bit. And I just hope a reminder that we can be wanting to be open and not fearful that the open public democratic process is a trusting good thing. And I think that's how we develop the ideas of continual sustainable peace. And community, and good luck in those efforts. And it's important goals to work for, I think, that we work on that each session and work for something better. That's growth, and that's the little things that build our positive future. So good luck in those efforts, and as always, good luck in how to consider a name change of UASC. I think there can be a way to do that, and so I would be thinking of that. And capitalist, if we're practicing capitalist practices, let's always have a good reasoning about it and not lose sight of our better human selves in this capitalist tradition that this country seems to continuously want to promote. Thank you for your time.